I hope everybody in this room has a copy of and has read his book, The Prodigal God. If you haven't, that ought to be your first buy when you leave here, not counting the ones that you recommended for the conference. The Prodigal God is an extended study of Luke 15 and the chapter that contains one parable in three acts. We know the prodigal son, which is the last part of the thing, but key to the prodigal son is the first two, the lost sheep and the lost coin, where you have something that's lost of great value. There's a deep search for it. We have to find this thing, this lamb, this coin, and when we find it, we celebrate. First time, second time, and then third time, it's a son. And the son is lost. And the son comes home, and the father shames himself by hiking up his garments and running down the road after a son who has shamed his father by asking for his inheritance early, which is tantamount to saying, "Dad, I wish you were dead so I could become the heir." And the father doesn't wait to find out whether the son's repented. He doesn't wait to find out what's on his son's heart and mind. He runs. He shames himself and he runs. And he calls for a party, just like they did with the lost sheep and the lost coin. But the kicker in the story finally makes his appearance. It's the older brother. Because the older brother, who has been diligently serving dad all these years, he's ticked. Number one, he's the older brother. He was due to inherit a substantial portion of the estate, and his estate was compromised by his younger brother's silliness and sin. Number two, he never gets a party. He doesn't get his father's blessing. Not like that. So he's opposed to the party. The whole parable is set against the backdrop of the opening verses of Luke 15, which really kind of explain Jesus' point in telling the parable. The opening verse goes like this: "Now the tax collectors and sinners," the tax collectors and sinners, "were all drawing near to hear Jesus, and the Pharisees and the scribes grumbled, saying, 'This man receives sinners and eats with them.'" Now that's the setup for the parable. And the parable really explains why this whole matter of sonship is such a big deal today. Because there are two sides of this road we can get off of. Last night I suggested to you that sonship really takes its meaning and its definition from early Genesis, where we were made in the image of God to do two things. Number one, be intimate with our Father, enjoy. And number two, to conduct the Father's business in the world. That's what sonship is. To be intimate with dad and to conduct the father's family business in the world. But when sin enters and we become sinners, it affects us in two ways. It affects the intimacy of the relationship, and it affects our ability to do the family business. And you can go off that road on either of those two ways. Now, when we talk theologically, which the Bible often does, doesn't always talk theologically, sometimes it talks narrative, as I've been suggesting, but theologically, we have names for those two curbs that we can get off of. The first is legalism, and the second is, there's two options, antinomianism, a big long word, or libertinism. It's the idea I can do whatever I want. I have such liberty that I don't have to obey. I'm saved, I don't have to serve. I want to unpack those a little bit because we're dealing with the two sons of Luke 15. We're dealing with the son who went and lived however he wanted, and he wasted his life. The word prodigal doesn't mean naughty returnee. The word prodigal means one who wastes. And Keller's argument is that the prodigal son story is not about the son. It's about a father whose love appears to be wasted on two sons, neither of whom deserve it. Fascinating, fascinating study. Now, let's look first at legalism. In your table discussion materials, and if you're a table host, I'm going to steal just a tad of your thunder. I suggested that you might read this at the table, but because you only have one more time to do this, I'm going to read it first. Listen to this definition of legalists. I got this from a blog that came right as I was preparing to write these talks, and I thought this is a nice way to summarize it. This is a Viola. I think his name is Frank Viola, and he writes a blog, and it's a good one. It's listed in your material. Legalists are people who believe salvation is by grace alone, but sanctification, the holy making of us, comes by their own efforts of trying hard to be a good Christian. Legalists tend to push their own personal standards onto everyone else. They're quick to judge other people's motives, thinking the worst of them and their intentions. They confuse obedience with trying to serve God in their own strength. They demand other people do things that they themselves would never carry out. They regard... I have a vivid image of Jimmy Swaggart. You remember Jimmy Swaggart, the televangelist? I remember I was doing some advanced studies, and I had to write a paper on televangelism. So I'm scanning all these televangelists, and I'm watching the way they operate. I'm watching the way they walk around a stage. I'm watching the props. I'm analyzing all this stuff to see if there's any themes. And I remember watching a sermon that Jimmy Swaggart preached. He was thundering against sexual sins. Just one after another, pounding on the church for its sexual sins. And the next day he was exposed for having been paying prostitutes and having affairs. And legalists. We all know that. We all know it about ourselves. There are sins that we will point out about other people, and we thunder against them, and we harbor the same sins in our heart. Philip Yancey described the legalist perfectly when he said, Christians get very angry toward other Christians who sin differently than they do. Legalism is the first distortion of sonship because it buys into an equation that our hearts want desperately to believe. I'm talking about a mathematical equation. Here's the equation. Religion plus behavior equals acceptance by God. We really want to believe, our hearts want to believe, that if we're religious and our behavior is good, God's going to love us more. Every night when you go to bed, no matter how sweet has been your fellowship with the Lord that day, every night when you go to bed, your heart hits a reset button, and the next morning you wake up believing the equation. It's automatic. It's the default of the human heart. We want desperately to believe that our behavior matters in God's acceptance of us. And that's why a lot of us who are reformed and who believe in the doctrine of total depravity, that the effects of our sin and the depravity of our hearts is comprehensive. It touches every sphere of our life. It touches our thought life, our intellectual life. It touches our sexual behavior. It touches our relationships. There's not a dimension of our life that's not compromised by sin. We find great comfort when we turn to Romans 7. And we read in Romans 7, oh, wretched man that I am, the good that I want to do, I don't. And the evil that I don't want to do, that's what I do. Wretched man that I am. But you see, the problem with Romans 7 is not just that verse. That verse is just in the middle of an argument. The argument is, how is it that you come to acceptance by God? How is it that you and I, who sin like pros, I mean, we're professionals at it. We sin all the time, right? We struggle all the time with temptation. We struggle all the time with the weakness of our flesh. We thunder against somebody else's sexual sins, but if our thought life was known to everybody else, wow. Why is it that behavior according to the laws of God does not achieve the righteousness God desires? Well, that's the question in Romans 7. And what Paul wrestles with in Romans 7 is this question. The law, why can't the Torah, the law, to which I've given myself all of my days. I mean, wow, Paul's a student of Gamaliel, PhD, University of Jerusalem, Gamaliel, best teacher in the world. This guy was the prime student of Torah law. And he looks at his life and he looks at himself and he says, why is it that, is the problem the law? Is that why I can't quit sinning? No, the law's good. Well, what's the problem then? The problem's in here. My sinful flesh meets a good law, and I can't keep it. Why then would I cling to a system that says my acceptance depends on behavior which I can't offer? That's the problem with legalism. It doesn't work. It never has. It cannot. And God knows it. The God who made us and who watched his son go into rebellion and sin knew that the law he would establish would be a standard that his son couldn't keep. Do you think your father wants to expect something from you that you can't offer? I remember, I'm not a very good golfer, but I have a very good mental game. My mental game of what I think my golf game is like is much better than my actual game. You familiar with this? I remember with my son, who's got a gorgeous swing, just beautiful swing. I remember being on a range with him, and we're hitting balls, and I'm just admiring how flexible he is and how strong he is and how far he hits the ball. And then we went to the putting range where he never practices. So he can have a 5-foot putt and putt it 30 foot past the hole because he's got no touch. And so I'm trying to encourage him a little bit. And over here in the corner is, this is not about the Chinese, but there's a Chinese father and a Chinese son, and the son's about 8. And the son's working on 3-foot putts, and he's missing the putts, and the father is just beating this guy up. He's just hollering at him. He's talking about how he's dishonoring the family name because he can't make a, I mean, it's just, it's ridiculous. And the son stands up and turns around and he's got Coke bottle bottom glasses. The kid can't see. And I thought to myself, here's a dad demanding of a son something that this poor kid can't do. Can't do it. Legalism is the sadly distorted belief by sons that, yeah, we can do what the Father knows we can't do. And I think it comes because we look at our lives and we see our sin and we just cannot possibly believe that our Father loves us as we are. We just can't believe that. We can't factor it into our head equation that our Father loves broken, failing, messy sons. And then you turn to the prodigal son parable and you meet a broken, messy, failed son who's wasted his father's inheritance, who's wasted his life. He's probably got a venereal disease. He's been dining with pigs, which is, I mean, that's like living in Skid Row and eating out of dumpsters in the Jewish world. It's about as offensive as you can get. And he comes home, tail between his legs, stinking, smelly, broke. There's nothing left. And he's rehearsing his speech. He says, I got to tell Dad that I'm sorry. I'm not worth anything. I got nowhere else to turn. My life is a mess. Dad beats him to the punch. Dad's running down the road, an old man shaming himself, lifting up his garments, running, crying, wraps his arm around the stinking hulk of a failed son, and hugs him and cries and kisses him and says, you're my son, I love you. That's how God deals with legalists. He just wears them down. I inferred last night just a little hint of a part of a story in my life. I told you about when my wife died. What I didn't tell you last night is that I have four kids, and three of them grew up overnight in a year. They're astonishing kids, and I had nothing to do with it. It was just God's grace. They're just amazingly mature. They handle the burdens of life with godly wisdom. They married godly people. And then there's number one. Number one, Jennifer, my oldest, got so mad at God when her mother died. She got so mad at herself because she was acting out in the last year before her mother died. She was chasing around with guys that her mother didn't approve of. She was doing a lot of drinking. She was doing a lot of other stuff that we didn't know about then, we know about now. And my answer? I hauled her in and I said, listen, your mother's dying. I need you to behave yourself. Great legalist. You just haul off and pound on her about her behavior, right? And so she hated me. And she ran. She ran from me and she ran from God and she ran from the church. And she ran for 12 years. We had a couple of, I guess what you call interventions. She went from one bad marriage, had two children, to a non-marriage where she lived with another guy and had a third child. And then she kicked that guy out and she was living with another guy. And so the family would periodically all meet in Dallas. We'd fly out, we'd meet with her, we'd try to tell her how much we loved her, but she wasn't getting it. And then an elder in that church, an elder I had trained, He surpassed the teacher, I tell you. He was a 33-year-old elder, professor of electrical engineering at the University of Texas, Dallas. Called me on the phone and said, I want you in my office. I want to talk to you about your daughter. So I flew out there and met in his office. And I expected that we were there to talk about a strategy for connecting with Jennifer and convincing her that she was destroying her life and she needed really desperately to clean up her act. I walked in the room and there was Jennifer. And Larry sat us down and we had the preliminaries and he poured the coffee and he said, well, we're here to talk about your sin, John. I said, huh? He said, we're here to talk about your sin. Your sin is getting to be the problem in this relationship. He called me out on being a legalist. Now, he loved me. He loved me a lot. He cared about me a lot. And he knew that I wasn't the only sinner in the room. But he also knew that my daughter needed to know that I wasn't squeaky clean, righteous older brother. I was a mess. I was trying my best to be a dad. I was trying my best to love her, but I was a mess, and so was she, and we had to get onto the same playing field so that we could have a conversation. And the only way Larry thought we could get on the same playing field was to beat me up first. And so we talked about that, and I looked at my daughter, and I said, you know what, Larry's right. I've been hard on you. I've been angry with you. I've loved you, but I haven't done it well. I asked you to forgive me. And she looked at me and she said, what? I said, I'm asking you to forgive me. I will always love you. I don't like what's happened to your life because I think it's hurting you, but I haven't handled it well. And she said, okay. And she stood up and walked out. And I looked at Larry, I said, that went well. He said, I hope it did. But he said, we had to bulldoze all that crap off the table so that you could actually talk with her, and maybe you will now. And then we spent the next half an hour praying for her, and he's still my hero. He's just an awesome young man. Well, 3 years later, I get a phone call. By now I'm in Jacksonville. And it's Jennifer, and she says, Dad? I said, what? She said, I got nowhere to go. So-and-so's been beating me up, and he's threatening the boys, and I've been working two jobs trying to make ends meet, and I just got fired, and I'm broke, and I don't know what, I don't know where to go. And I said, you come here. And she hesitated and she said, really? I said, yeah. So we flew out to Dallas. We bought a bunch of those oversized, ginormous duffel bags and we packed all their stuff in the duffel bags, eight of them. We rented a storage unit, put all the crappy furniture. I wanted to throw it out, but I didn't want to destroy her hope. We just packed that all up, and we got on a plane, and we flew to Jacksonville, and she walked in the house, and she went into the back bedroom, and she sat there for an hour and cried. And I thought later, can you imagine how ashamed she must have been? She had nothing, everything she had tried in her life for 12 years had been an absolute waste, and it was ruined. It was empty. There was nothing left. And my wife and I had lots of conversations during these trips, and we had been reflecting on Luke 15 and on legalism. And we had made a commitment to one another that we were not going to treat her in a legalistic fashion. We were going to love her like the Father. And I was right in the middle of a series of sermons on the parables in Luke, and it so happened that 3 weeks after she moved there, I got to Luke 15. And I preached that passage, and I didn't refer to her, but she saw my heart. And that night she came home and she said to me, "You've changed." I said, "Yeah, God's changed me. He's changing me." And she said, "I like the new you." And she went back to the bedroom. Next day I had to go up to RTS and begin a course that I was teaching, so I was gone for an entire week teaching. During that week, my wife led her back to Jesus. And she embraced Christ with a whole heart. She had to do it with my wife, not me, because I was part of the problem yet, right? So I came home at the end of the week, and Jennifer came up to me, and tears streaming down her face. And Carol had called me to tell me, and I had already had my weeping moment. Jennifer wrapped her arms around me, and she said, "Daddy, I'm home." Well, we both cried like babies for a long time. And we sat and we talked for hours, hours, about how legalism had made her feel. She said, "I knew I couldn't please you, but all I tried to do was to earn your love, and every time I tried, I screwed it up." That's what legalism does. And that's why legalism kills the sense of being the sons of God, because we buy something into our souls that isn't true and doesn't work. We buy into an equation that says my worth and my relationship with my Father depends upon success in an area I can't succeed in. Like the kid with the glasses, can't see, therefore can't putt. Like a daughter who's lost her way, can't see, therefore can't navigate a broken world without falling prey to its allures. But there's another way you can fall off the rails, and that's libertinism. Libertinism is a new one and an old one. It was already an issue in Paul's day, and it is a real profound issue today. Let me just read you a quick definition of what that looks like. In reaction to legalism and the devastation that it brings to other people, some have accepted the gospel of libertinism. Libertines are folks who live the way they want and have skirted the lordship of Christ and all that that means. They are apt to justified carnality. That's a word for living according to the flesh, doing what your body and your wants tell you. Living by your passions, Paul says in Ephesians. They're apt to justify this by pulling the grace card, the I'm free in Christ card, and the don't judge me card. For the libertine, grace becomes license to live in the flesh and silence their conscience. Some libertines have rationalized to themselves that they can continue to practice a particular transgression and God is cool with it, regardless of the carnage it brings. A mark of sin, by the way, is that it produces unnecessary pain in the lives of others. Sin and love are the exact opposites. Love is benefiting others at the expense of yourself. Sin is benefiting yourself at the expense of others. Sin is selfishness. Love is selflessness. Love is a greater force than sin. God's life is more powerful than Satan's nature, and love covers a multitude of sins. That's a good quote to talk about later on. Chat at your tables about that. Now, what is this libertinism? You guys remember Lord of the Rings? How many of you here have seen the Lord of the Rings trilogy? Oh, good, good. Tolkien wrote Lord of the Rings about the power of evil, right? He called it the Ring of Power because he identified that the source of palpable evil in the world is the pursuit of power and autonomy. Do you know when he wrote that? In the shadow of Nazi Germany's rise. And in the shadow of Stalin's great devastations of Russia. End of the Second War in the first few years after. He published it in 54, 55. He was writing it during the war. Now, you think about those movies, and you think about the orcs and how ugly they were, and the goblins and how ugly they were, and how powerful they were. And you think about that force of evil that destroys everything. And it is all in quest of one thing: autonomy. The power to run my life the way I want to run my life. But when I run my life that way, I destroy everybody around me. That was 1955. You know what that looks like today in the United States? Keller and others have identified it very well by talking about the idols of our generation. And they suggest that the idols of our generation are nothing other than the ancient pursuit for the ring of power. I want to be autonomous, and you can't tell me how to live. Either can Jesus. Here are the three expressions of the ring of power today. I have to be autonomous in regard to my body and sex. Don't put a grid on my sexual behavior. I get to live how I will. Secondly, money. Money, gotta have resources, wealth. The pursuit of wealth gives me autonomous freedom. If I have enough, I can live any way I want to. That one's not just a sin of the young, that one's a sin of the old as well. And the third, simple power, authority. I've gotta have a position where I can dictate rather than be dictated to. Sex, money, power. Those are the three idolatries of an autonomous culture, and they reign in life today. Now, how is it that the church has gotten to the point where Christians have the same idolatries as non-Christians? Well, because we've lost what sonship means. You remember last night I told you sonship in Genesis 1 implied two things. Number one, intimacy. God walked and talked with Adam in the garden in the cool of the day. They were open, they were intimate. It was awesome. And the second was doing business in the Father's name. Right? Adam woke up every morning and he knew he was in God's world, and he was doing God's business, and he was unfurling and unfolding God's creation to bring glory to God. There was clarity about his role. It was great. You know what being a son of God today is? In many churches, it's a walk down an aisle. It's a business transaction like buying insurance. And then after you've signed the document on the last page, somebody says to you, and by the way, the Bible teaches the security of the believer. So now that you've signed, you're in. You're never going to lose it. Doesn't matter what you do. Oh, you mean I don't have to change anything? I can pursue the idols of my heart and it doesn't matter? Yep, because it's just a transaction, and you've done the transaction, you're safe. We've lost what the Bible says about the transformation. You remember when God made Adam? He breathed into him the breath of God. He breathed into him, the Hebrew word is nephesh. He blew into that pile of dust life. Do you know how you become a son of God? We've got a theology of adoption, but we also have a theology of being born again. You know what that looks like? He bends down into your messy, broken, sin-filled life, and he breathes the Spirit of God, and he recreates you like he once created Adam. And he blows his Spirit into you. And if you don't think that changes you, you don't understand salvation at all. God meets you right where you are, but then he blows his life breath into you. And that life breath begins to percolate and pulse, and you begin to live by the Spirit of God. You're not accepted because you behave. You're accepted because he loves. But when he loves, you begin to behave, because now you're on the Father's business, and you've got a new spirit, and you've got a new pulse. And you would never assume that, changed by the love of the Father, you intend to live like you did before you knew him. That makes no sense at all. Those are the two lies the devil wants to tell us, to keep us from being fully formed and joyous sons of God. He wants us to believe, on the one hand, that it all depends on our behavior, whether God accepts us. And we know that doesn't work. And many of us have had experiences in church with legalists, like my daughter did with her dad. And it didn't help. And I had to reach out to her like a father in the prodigal son story. I had to go running after her. I had to love her where she was. And then God could work with her heart. And so in reaction to the legalists, we become libertines. We are bound and determined to be free, autonomous, following the gods our heart already cherishes. And then the Father says, that's not the family way. I gave you a different spirit than that. Let's live by that spirit. Here's my challenge at the end of this talk, just real brief. Last night, I took you on this long journey, and I brought you to the curtain in the temple. And when Jesus died, God, from the top to the bottom, tore it and dismissed the cherubim that were keeping us from him. And he said, come on home, right? Here's the question for you today. This is personal. Do you believe the curtain is torn? It's not a historical question. That's a reality question. Do you believe the curtain's torn and your Father takes you into fellowship with him because Jesus died on your behalf? Do you accept that? Do you acknowledge that that's the source of your return to full sonship? That's the thing that's hamstringing a lot of us. We can't buy that. We would rather run to the equation. No. Acceptance has to be about religion plus behavior. Has to be about religion plus behavior. We've heard it from our dads maybe. We've heard it from our moms maybe. We've heard it from our pulpits maybe. Some of us in this room have perpetuated that lie with our own kids, like I did with my oldest. Before God in grace gave me the privilege to correct my errors and see her come home. I don't know where the legalism comes from, and I don't know where all that stuff comes from in your life, but I ask you this simple question. Do you believe what God says about the curtain being open? Do you? Because if you do, God's truth is more powerful than how you feel about you. you will still wake up tomorrow morning feeling like God will accept me better if I behave better. That's going to be your daily struggle all the rest of your days. You will never wake up without that equation rearing its ugly head in your soul. The daily question is, do I believe the curtain's torn? Period. If I believe the curtain's torn, I put the equation away. I put it away because it's a lie. You got to remember what Satan means. The name of Satan means he's in the business of trying to deceive you into believing that lie. That's his daily strategy. He wants you to believe a faulty equation. God wants to look you in the eye and say, hey, brother, the curtain's torn. You're my son. You're home. Do you believe what God says? Or do you believe the false equation? And secondly, if you believe what God says, help others believe it too. Dallas Willard, great professor of philosophy at USC, Southern California, not South Carolina, says that most discipleship models in the church have gotten off the rails on that. What we do with our discipleship is to really pound on folks to make sure that they have external conformity to behaviors, right? We pound on behavior management. And secondly, we make sure they have correct doctrine. And the unintended result of both of those is that we create a culture of legalism in the church. We're telling people all the time that unless you behave right and believe right, you can't be accepted by God. He says, yeah, these things matter, but you know what we have to teach people first? First thing we got to teach them? That they're sons of God because of Jesus. And that therefore they get to rejoice in it because of the Father's love. And only if those two things get taught do those other two things matter. But you know what? That's not just Rob's job here. That's not just the elder's job. That's your job. When you go home, if you've got kids, you got to teach your kids that they are accepted by God because Jesus brought them home. You have a wife. Maybe she's got self-esteem issues. It's your job to say to your wife that she's accepted by God and you because of the love of the Father. Period. Period. End of story. That's got to be the way we interact with one another in community. In the next talk, I'm going to talk about what that looks like in specifics. But for now, do you believe it? And will you share it? If you do, you conduct the family business in the Father's name. Okay, I'm done for this one.
All right, I'm going to give away a book here, and then I'm going to give you a break. I got three trivia questions, so you got to get one of these right.